Welcome to the Out of Chicago podcast. I'm Chris Smith, and this is the podcast where we bring you the world's best photographers in iconic locations, and it couldn't get any better than what we're doing right now. I've got Michael Fry, and we're in the middle of Yosemite Park taking a walk. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for doing this. And all morning you went out and you were helping us. We did videos and we just got some brunch, I guess it was. And now we're just walking around. It's beautiful here. Now, Michael has been, you lived here inside or just outside Yosemite Park the last 35 years. Is that right? Tell us a little of your history here in Yosemite.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So yes, I've been here for 35 years, lived right here in Yosemite Valley for a good portion of that, about, almost 25 years. My wife was the manager at the Ansel Adams Gallery during that time, so we got housing through her job, and she did that while we were raising our son, and I was, you know, starting out as a professional photographer and trying to make that work. And then we moved outside the park and now live in Mariposa, which is about an hour away, but it's still really close by. So this is, you know, kind of my backyard. And my favorite photo location, as you can imagine, it's a wonderful place to do photography, especially if you're a landscape photographer. And so I've been photographing this place for 35 years and still love coming here and still love photographing Yosemite, all different parts of the park and all different seasons. I don't know, what else do you want me to say?
No, we have so much to talk about. I mean, you've written the Photographer's Guide to Yosemite.
Yeah.
We've got it as an app on our phone now, which is great. It's really the book, but all in a nicely organized digital way, right. Which is what we've been using as we've been scouting. I'm here with Ann and Michelle, and we are scouting Yosemite to do an out of Yosemite event.
Yeah.
And it's going to be our first winter event here in Yosemite.
Yeah. That should be great. Winter is a wonderful time here. It's my favorite season to photograph Yosemite. You know, I love photographing Yosemite in all different seasons, and there are things to be said about all of them. But winter is quieter, less people, but it's also the season with, I think, the most interesting light and usually the most interesting weather. That's when we get most of the storms here in Yosemite. And whether it's rain or snow, just having the clouds and mist around the valley adds so much to photographs of this place. And, you know, and that's one of the things that keeps me coming back, right? So I can go to the same place, but if the weather's different, if the light's different, if the clouds and mist are different, I can make a photograph that might be different than any other photograph that I've taken, even from the same spot.
Yeah, one thing I've learned from reading your book and from being here is because the walls of the valley are so high, where that sun's coming in, the angle really makes a huge difference, time of day and time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true in most places, or certainly a lot of places, that, you know, we tend to think of wanting to photograph around sunrise and sunset early and late in the day. But the angle that the sun rises and the angle that the sun sets changes, obviously, in winter or summer, depending on the season, depending on where you are in the world. And that angle makes a big difference. It can make a really big difference in some places, and certainly this is one of those places where, you know, in wintertime, certain rock formations will get light early and late in the day, and others just, you know, nothing. They don't get any sun whatsoever. In summer, it's completely flipped. It's different formations, waterfalls, cliffs, etc., get that early and late day light. So it really does help to know it always helps to know an area well when you're trying to photograph it. And that's particularly true here, but I think it's really true anywhere. And it also, you know, these days you can also avail yourself of different, you know, tools to help you figure out where to be, you know, how the light's going to hit different things, or you know, where the sun's going to rise and all that kind of things. Things like photographer's ephemeris or photo pills, etc., can really help with that kind of stuff if you're not that, especially if you're not that familiar with an area.
Well, you were doing the photographer's ephemeris 3D, is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was crazy. I just saw you scroll through the different times, and you could mm-hmm. see where the light was hitting and where it wasn't in the valley.
Yeah, that's an awesome tool for doing that kind of stuff, so you can see how the light will fall on the landscape at, you know, any landscape. You don't have to actually be there, and at any time in the future. And so that obviously can be really helpful. And then you can sort of virtually plant yourself at a certain spot like you can with Google Earth, except that unlike Google Earth, you can also see, you know, from that spot how the light is going to fall on the land, or where the sun is going to be, or where the moon's going to be, etc.
Yeah, it was super cool when we went to go. You said, I want to get the sun coming right over the cliffs here, and then I'm going to get a starburst. And you, in the video, you showed how you shoot to get these starburst effects. And you said, well, according to this, in 10 minutes, the sun's going to be up. And what do you know, 10 minutes later, it's right there.
Yeah.
So that seems like an important tool, especially in a location like this.
Yeah.
What are a few of your favorite places to shoot here in Yosemite?
Wow. well, there's so many of them. So, you know, Tunnel View, it's got to be number one on my list. And it's such an iconic spot. You know, it's the most iconic spot in Yosemite. There's quite a few, but that's got to be number one on the list. And you know, it's for a good reason. It's a wonderful spot for photographs. It's just got so many elements going on that help to make great compositions. Just the way the rock formations and the land is laid out from there. The way you have that flat valley floor bounded by big cliffs on the side, and sort of the balance of everything is really sweet. It really works well, as I said, for a lot of different things.
And for people that don't know it, they see kind of all the iconic spots. I mean, you see Bridalveil Falls, you see Half Dome, you see El Capitan, all from that same shot. And like you said, it's a good balance to how it's laid out.
Yeah. But the thing about Tunnel View, as opposed to I suppose some other iconic spots, some other spots that lots of photographers go to, is that there's a lot more variety there than in some other places. Like, I think, Mesa Arch is the first place that comes to mind, right? You know, that everybody goes to. That's, in case you don't know where that is, that's in Canyonlands National Park in Utah. And there's sort of, you can do different variations on that idea there. So the idea is you get this glow underneath the arch and at sunrise, and you can do different variations on that idea, but it's basically the same idea and the same light for that idea. While as with Tunnel View, there are a lot more possibilities. And there are some other iconic spots that are like that too, where you have a lot more options. But Tunnel View is a good example of that, where, first of all, the scene looks so different depending on the time of day and the weather. And you don't just have to photograph it at, you know, a certain time. You can photograph it at sunrise or sunset or at different times of year, or even during the middle of the day if the weather's right. And, you know, it so much depends on the clouds, the mist, the light. Maybe you get a rainbow, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of possibilities there. And there's not just one composition. There is sort of a, I don't know, classic standard composition from there, but there are a lot of variations of that. You can go wider, you can go narrower, you can use long telephoto lenses from there and pick out a piece of the landscape instead of doing the wide view. So it's really rich, I think, in that sense. So Tunnel View is a great spot, someplace that even though I've been there many times, I keep going back to. But lots of other spots around the valley floor. Again, you know, some of the classic spots, they're classic for a reason, like Gates of the Valley, a.k.a. Valley View. And again, you know, that's a spot that a lot of photographers go to, and it's because it works. You know, it has a lot of wonderful elements going on there. But there are also, you know, much more obscure places in the park that, you know, that I've gotten to know over the years that I love going to as well. Places in the high country, which you can get to during the summer or fall, like Tenaya Lake, the areas around Tuolumne Meadows and Tioga Pass, up in the high country. Those are all wonderful. And even here in the valley, there are sort of these little nooks and crannies that I've explored over the years, and I keep discovering new ones, believe it or not, even after all this time, that are really wonderful places to do like more intimate landscape type scenes. And I do a lot of that. You know, certainly I photograph the iconic views here, you know, the cliffs, the waterfalls, all that kind of stuff. But I love photographing smaller scenes as well. And Yosemite Valley is a wonderful place for that too. You know, as we're recording this, the dogwoods are blooming here. Mm-hmm. And there are just so many beautiful compositions that you can make of just, you know, just part of a dogwood or one dogwood or even, you know, a few blossoms or whatever. And so many things like that throughout the year that you can photograph here.
So you answered like 7 questions right there that I had for you. That's okay. You're making me run out of questions now. But kind of the one big one, which you really hinted at when you're talking about Tunnel View, is how do you take these places that are just iconic locations from Ansel Adams, the classic photographers over the last 30, 40, 50 years, and get an image that you can call your own that is unique? What are some of the tips you would give people to help create something like that?
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question, and a question that I don't think there's a really easy answer to, but I can give you some possibilities. So I mentioned one of them, which is you can be at one of those well-known photographic spots and simply photograph it under different conditions than, you know, than maybe people usually get there. So, you know, weather plays such a big role in landscape photography, and nowhere more so than here. So just photographing one of those scenes with different weather, different light, you know, I'm constantly discovering sort of new perspectives on some of these places just because the weather looks different. But another way is to, you know, look for those smaller scenes and to find things that are not as obvious. And, you know, I think that's something that, well, first of all, it's something I love doing. But I think it's something that can be more personal. So, you know, you are using your eyes, you're using your imagination to maybe find a composition that other people wouldn't see just because you have your own unique way of seeing the world. You bring your own tastes and sensibilities and experience to everything that you see, and you might notice things that other people wouldn't. So that's certainly a way that you can make images that are more personal, I guess. And I think though there's a, you know, we can get into this conversation, which I think is a really interesting one, about sort of photographing these well-known spots that a lot of photographers go to. And there's a lot of ambivalence about that, I guess you would say. You know, like I felt that certainly when I first came here and I started doing photography. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I can't compete with the likes of Ansel Adams, you know, so why should I even bother?
Why
should I be doing those kinds of photos, you know? And actually, I did sort of avoid that for a while. In fact, my early career as a photographer, I did a lot of wildlife photography. That was really my specialty. And I did a lot of that here in Yosemite. But I also focused on, you know, smaller landscapes and things like that. And I would photograph, you know, some of the big scenes when opportunities presented themselves, but didn't really feel like I could do anything that hadn't been done before. And then at a certain point, I just sort of realized that that didn't matter to me. You know, that that I should just make photographs that I want to make, that I enjoy making, that say, you know, what I want to say about a place or about nature or whatever it is that I'm photographing, and not worry about whether it's super original or not. Just enjoy doing what I'm doing, make photos that I like. If it's not the most original photo in the world, that's fine. And along the way, you know, you sort of discover things that are original or at least different. And so I think I actually started to make, well, first of all, started to make better big landscape images of Yosemite when I stopped worrying about that. But also started to make things that were different, that were more original, just because I wasn't hung up about it one way or the other. You know, just kind of wasn't thinking about trying to copy something or try to avoid copying something, but just do what I wanted to do and what the moment and the situation seemed to demand, I guess.
Yeah, so I love this idea of the small scene,
Yeah. Something
that is special, that means something to you. You've created something that's different. It's much easier than standing at Tunnel View or whatever,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
What would we be looking for when we come back in the winter as far as small scenes? Because we're not going to have the dogwoods. It's not going to be ferns. What are you going to have there?
Oh, there's so many possibilities, you know. So ice along the river, along some of the creeks, that's one of my favorite things to photograph. There are so many interesting patterns and designs you can find in ice. And if you're in kind of the right place at the right time, you can find reflections of the cliffs in the ice. So they'll create this kind of golden color in the ice. You know, if there's snow, then just snow-covered trees, the river winding through snow-covered trees, cascading water with snow or ice around it, all those kinds of things. And as always, again, you know, weather plays such a big part in landscape photography, but, you know, if you can combine some of those elements, any of those elements with, mist or fog or something like that, then so much the better. Let me think. Snow-covered rocks along the Merced River. Anything else. It's really, when you're doing that kind of stuff, I think you you have to sort of let yourself be guided by just whatever catches your eye. You know, it sometimes you can go out with something specific in mind, but a lot of times it just pays to wander around and look, and something catches your eye, and then you see if you can make a composition out of that, whatever it might be.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, right?
You know, and yeah, sometimes things don't work, but you never know unless you explore that. Like, you know, again, something catches your attention and you can just try to see if there's a way to make a composition out of it. And that doesn't always work, but more often than not, if something caught your eye to begin with, there's something there.
Now, when we do our event here, we want to do a lot of black and white photography. I mean, this is kind of like the home, I feel, of landscape photography. And a lot of that was born, obviously, with black and white photography. So we're going to get some of the world's best black and white photographers to be here teaching and helping people. Give me your thoughts, because you don't do a ton of black and white, but from what I've seen, the black and white you do is awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I love doing black and white, and as you say, I don't do a lot of it, but I love doing it. And you know, a lot of the fundamentals of photography apply whether you're doing color or doing black and white. But I mean, an obvious situation where you might choose to do black and white over color is simply when there's not that much color in the scene you're photographing. And Yosemite is, you know, it's a wonderful, beautiful place, but the cliffs are, you know, gray and brown, and trees are mostly pines, and, you know, not the most colorful place in the world under normal circumstances. So there's a lot of opportunity to make images that are really more suited to black and white. And so, you know, again, obviously, if there's not a lot of color in the scene, but sometimes even if there is, even if there's some color there, the color can be a distraction rather than an addition to the image. I think black and white works really well for showing forms and shapes and lines and textures, and that's you know, that's a lot of what photography is about. It's a lot of what composition is about, is looking for those kinds of elements and combining them into some sort of cohesive whole, a cohesive image. And so black and white really strips things down to the fundamentals, you know, kind of just getting color out of the picture. Gets you down to those essentials. And so, you know, here in Yosemite, with that beautiful winter light, sometimes you can get, depending on, you know, you have to figure out when the right time is for this, but you can get the light raking across one of the cliffs and bringing out the texture of that cliff, the sort of three-dimensionality of it. Or you have, you know, snow-covered trees, and you're working with that contrast between, you know, the white snow and, you know, dark branches of the trees. So there are a ton of different elements that can work really well for black and white photography here any time of year, but I think especially in winter, and especially if, you know, if we're lucky enough to have snow when we're here in winter.
So maybe it's a good time to make a little transition into talking about some post-processing.
Okay.
First off, you know, what do you do for a black and white conversion, and what do you work in? And just tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah. Well, I use Lightroom for almost everything that I do. And, you know, I actually started my sort of digital photography journey back in the late 90s, and I was using film and getting the film scanned and then taking it into Photoshop. And So I sort of cut my teeth on Photoshop, and I know Photoshop really well. But as Lightroom has become more and more powerful over the years, I've found that I use that more and more, and Photoshop less and less, because I can do almost everything that I'd want to do in Lightroom, and be able to just do it in one place, kind of stick to one program for organizing my images as
and
well
as
processing.
It's non-destructive. You can go back and make tweaks.
Yeah, I love that aspect of it. You know, just Photoshop, you can make Photoshop behave in a non-destructive way most of the time, but it wasn't really designed from the ground up to do that. So you kind of have to know how to do that, to work in that way. You know, using adjustment layers, really just using layers for everything that you do. But there are some situations in Photoshop where it's hard to avoid sort of going down a one-way street, where if you do a whole bunch of things and then you decide that later that you didn't like something you did earlier, your only option is to go back and sort of start over. Well, that never happens in Lightroom. So yeah, that's one of the things I love about it. And just working directly in with the raw data from the file instead of a derivative, I think has its advantages too. So yeah, I use Lightroom for most of the processing I do, and I use it for black and white conversions. You know, I think it's excellent for that. There's the new profile browser in Lightroom, relatively new, that gives you some more options for doing black and white and black and white conversions. And and it's really a really pretty simple thing to do in Lightroom, and to kind of figure out how to translate the colors in an image into tones of black and white.
Is this a good time to call it halfway, turn back?
Yeah.
Yeah? I mean, it doesn't loop, right?
No. Yeah.
All right, so keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, no, I think I...
So you do your black and white conversions just right in Lightroom?
Yeah, I do. I know a lot of people like to use other things like silver effects, for example. But I find, again, that I can do all I need to do in Lightroom. And one of the things that I know that silver effects is good for is toning black and white, you know, creating slightly different tints and tones to black and white images. And I actually, for that, when I'm printing black and white, I tend to rely more on the printer and the paper to do that for me. That gets into kind of a whole, you know, a whole nother topic. But that's all I think I need. So
tell me what sorts of things you do in Lightroom when you're doing the black and white conversion. Mm. So I always just think it's like the V key or whatever is what, maybe that's the shortcut key or whatever to put it in there. But then obviously you're doing something for contrast. You're doing, are you also working with like the different hues? I guess it's not called HSL when you're doing black and white,
right,
but you know what I'm saying.
It's the black and white mix.
Yeah.
So it used to be that you would convert an image to black and white, and then you could adjust the black and white mix. So the adjusting the black and white mix basically means translating the colors into black and white, into tones of gray. So, you know, for example, if you want the sky, the blue sky, to be a darker gray, then you can go into the black and white mix and pull down the blue slider and darken the blue sky. So you can kind of make the equivalent of colored filters for black and white film in Lightroom and in other programs in Photoshop and Silver Effects too. So, you know, when I'm talking about that, of course, a lot of listeners might not know what I'm talking about with colored filters with black and white film, but...
A lot of them do.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of them do. So, but in any case, what that means basically is putting a colored filter over the lens with black and white film alters how the colors are translated into shades of gray. A classic example of that is you photograph a red apple next to a green apple. And if you don't use any filter, then they're both going to look about the same shade of gray. But if you use a red filter, that will allow red light to pass through and block things that are sort of on the opposite side of the color spectrum, like green. So that'll make the red apple lighter and the green apple darker. And if you use a green filter, then you'll make the green apple lighter and the red apple darker. So you can do the equivalent of that, and actually with more nuance and more control in software, to adjust how different colors translate into shades of gray. And you can do that to bring out contrast or to make certain elements of the scene stand out or make them recede if you don't want them to be, you know, to sort of catch people's eye, catch people's attention. It's really, a powerful tool. Now, as I mentioned, Lightroom, or Adobe added the profile browser to Lightroom not too long ago, and that gives you some other options for doing black and white conversions. Basically, the way it's sort of set up now is that you choose a black and white profile, and then you can, if you want, on top of that, adjust the black and white mix to sort of further fine-tune things. And the profiles have different, lots of different looks to them, some of which also sort of imitate the looks of, a green filter or a red filter with black and white film.
We said that you actually don't do a ton of black and white stuff, so you're using Lightroom for everything you do. You have an entire book, a course, where you teach all this. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's called Landscapes in Lightroom, and it's an ebook and video package where I cover, among other things, black and white conversions, but really every aspect of processing images in Lightroom. And I go through some of the fundamentals, but I think the real essential part of it is I have 9 different examples of images that I go through, different kinds of images that present different challenges or whatever, high contrast, low contrast, so forth, and kind of take people step by step through how I would process them. And I think, when you're, whether it's Lightroom or any other piece of software, part of the challenge, I guess, is learning how to use the tools, right? So, just what the different tools do and so forth. But I think the more important element to processing images is knowing what to do with those tools, right? To figure out
why.
Yeah, exactly. To know, why you're using a tool for a certain thing, or really how you want the image to look. So I start off each example in the ebook by, kind of asking that question. Asking readers to take a minute to look at the image, and I start off with just a flat, unprocessed raw file. And, so take a look at the image, think about it for a minute, what do you think you would want to do to it if this was your photograph? And then I talk about, what I'm thinking of before I start processing it, just evaluating the image and thinking about where I'd want to go with it. And when it's your own photograph especially, you probably hopefully had, some idea in mind when you took the picture about what you were trying to say. And when you process it, you're really just trying to sort of emphasize that stuff. I don't think that you can take a bad photograph and turn it into something great with software But you can take a good image and you can make it better, or I would say you can sort of enhance its message. You can emphasize the message and make it clearer by your processing. And it really helps if you have a clear idea before you start about where you want to go with it. And again, I think it helps to think about your original intent, what you were trying to say, and see what you can do to bring that out. So as you go through the steps for processing the image, instead of just randomly pushing sliders around, you're thinking about what you want the photograph to say and whether this slider would help you to say that. And if so, you know, how?
So for people interested in the book and the course, where do we go to find that?
Well, on my website, michaelfrye.com, so michaelfrye.com. It's pretty easy. It's easy to find there. And you can sign up for my blog. Yeah, get my blog by email. I post pretty regularly, and
it's always helpful. I've been a member for a really long time. It's always it's not here's something to buy. It's always really good information.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Yeah.
I try to make it that way. You know, sometimes the blog posts are a story about how I made a photo, or you know, a trip that my wife Claudia and I have taken or something. But I try to most posts, rather than just posting an image, talk a little bit about, you know, how I made it, but maybe if there's some kind of a, try to throw in some kind of a little tip or lesson in with that, if possible. So, I've been doing the blog for a long time. I love doing it. It's, you know, it's a big part of what I do. And I'm lucky to have a really loyal group of followers for it. So,
yeah, and we don't have to go too deep into this, but you do workshops as well. Mm-hmm. And Michael's telling me, he's like, I don't even know if we should talk about them because they almost all sell out right away.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But tell me some of the places. Obviously, Yosemite. What are some other places you take people?
We do a workshop every year up in the Redwoods, Northern California coast, and we've done some in Death Valley. We usually do several each year over in the Mono Lake area. So we might go up into the Yosemite High Country, or just might be on the east side of the Sierra. They do fill up really quickly. But again, if you subscribe to my blog, then you'll get notices about workshops when they become available.
Yeah, so actually maybe you stole my thunder. I mean, my next question is just, like, what are your other favorite places? Yosemite obviously is, like such a great place, but what are your other favorite places to go to?
I mean, first of all, I'd say that I love the American West. I think it's just such a beautiful area of the world and such a playground for landscape photographers. You know, there's so much to do and, you know, anywhere west of the Mississippi. You know, really, there are beautiful places all over the world, but that's, you know, kind of my general stomping grounds. And so Yosemite and the Eastern Sierra, those are sort of my backyard places I go to all the time. But I love the Redwoods. That's really a place, an area of the world that I really connect with. You know, I love the redwood forests and the sort of wild, rocky coast along that area of the world. And I love, like so many people, the canyon country of, you know, southern Utah and northern Arizona, et cetera, those places. Yellowstone is a favorite place of mine, Tetons. I really love Yellowstone. It might be my second favorite national park. The geysers and thermal features there are pretty amazing and really fun to photograph, I think.
So. And it's one of your favorites for landscape. A lot of people think of it for wildlife, but
yeah. And I, you know, I tried doing some wildlife photography there back in the day, but these days, yeah, I go there to do landscapes and love it.
All right, so I have two really, really tough questions for you. One of them I didn't warn you about ahead of time, but I just came back. You know, and I don't even know how to ask this question without sounding like a big jerk. Not to you, but the question is, what is it? I mean, you've worked at the Ansel Adams Gallery. Your wife, Claudia, managed the gallery for a very long time. You've got this deep connection with Ansel Adams and the history here at Yosemite. Mm-hmm. But my question is this one that's a tough one, which is, what is it that really made Ansel as special as he is? Mm-hmm. Because so many people now that are just getting into photography, I hear them say things like, well, I see his pictures, but I saw one on Instagram that was just as good. It might have even been better.
Huh, yeah. Well, it's always hard to compare different eras. You know, I think, you know, that comes up in sports. You know, if you follow sports at all, people are always trying to compare, like, the great players of the past to the ones today. And it's really hard to do. So I think it's hard to compare you know, different eras of photography in a sense like that. But what made Ansel the photographer that we know so well is that he sort of took landscape photography from a place where before landscape photographers were photographing and portraying the land as kind of a static thing, mountains, rivers, lakes, but just this is what this part of the world looks like sort of thing. And Ansel was, you know, maybe not the first, but certainly one of the first, and the first to really do it so well that it sort of caught people's imagination, to combine the sort of the elemental landscape, right? The, you know, the cliffs and peaks and valleys and waterfalls and all that kind of stuff here in Yosemite, but it, you know, could be anywhere, with kind of a particular moment in time, a particular moment when the clouds and the light and the weather was just so. And that sort of creates this this feeling of a particular moment, but also in a strange sense, a sense of timelessness. Like there's this particular moment when this landscape looked this way, and it'll never come again. And that moment is preserved forever in one of his images. And, you know, that's what everybody does now. You know, at the time he did it, it was new. And now everybody does it. Everybody tries to make landscape photographs with, you know, special light and clouds and weather and so forth. But before he did it, that wasn't really a thing. You know, that wasn't something that people did. And partly that, of course, was the evolution of technology. You know, that in the very, very early days of landscape photography, using glass plates or whatever, they'd have to make a, you know, a minute-long exposure, and you couldn't capture clouds because they were moving and so forth. So, you know, by the time Ansel kind of came on the scene, you know, the equipment and the film and so forth had evolved to a point where you really could make, I don't know, sort of more dynamic landscape photographs that really captured a certain special moment. And I, you know, I still love his work. I think there are images of his that hold up to anything anybody's doing today. you know, his photograph clearing winter storm here in Yosemite is still my favorite Yosemite photograph. It just captures a certain feeling, a certain essence of this place, if you will, that you know, I don't know that anybody's ever done better. So that to me is just a wonderful classic photograph.
And he actually has some great examples of the small scenes that you're talking about
too. Absolutely. You know, he's best known for those, you know, kind of big iconic black and white landscapes of the American West, and but he did all kinds of things, but he did a lot of smaller scenes, more intimate landscapes. He did some wonderful ones here in Yosemite Valley, but elsewhere as well. But he did portraits. He did, you know, he made his living as a commercial photographer for much of his life. And so, you know, he photographed winemaking in the Napa Valley and, you know, all kinds of stuff, but, and did it really well. But yeah, he did, just in terms of nature and landscapes, he photographed all kinds of subjects in many different ways, and left a great legacy of work.
Yeah, so what I hear you saying and what I kind of gather from, you know, reading about Ansel in different places is that he kind of was the first person to go from photography being a way to document something to being an art form. Maybe not the first, but really led that.
Yeah, well, I certainly think there were people who came before him who made photographs that are still considered to be, you know, art, not just a document or documentation of something. But in terms of landscape photography, he sort of took it to the next step, the next place of, again, being that kind of more dynamic landscape of a dynamic landscape image of a certain special moment in time combined with the land itself.
So I still haven't gotten to the second tough question, but I want to interject one other little thing here. What's your thought then, from the time that he was doing that, and he was one of, you know, 10 or 100 people, 1,000 people in the world doing that sort of thing, you know, as his life went on, compared to when you started and maybe your first 10 years in photography and there were 10,000 people doing that, to now when there are hundreds of thousands, you know, of people doing that? How do you see that? I don't even know the question to ask, but...
Yeah, well, it's certainly changed a lot, you know, and photography has become more and more popular over the years. And then the advent of digital photography just sort of made that explode. You know, it went from, as you say, I don't know how many, how many serious photographers in the world, but, you know, that number certainly increased a lot in the last, you know, say, even 10 or 15 years. And, you know, I think it's great. I love photography. I'm glad that so many people also love it. And, you know, I love, you know, talking about photography and teaching photography. And there's, you know, lots of fellow people out there who share that passion. It's great. You know, certainly it has its impacts in terms of so many photographers wanting to go to, go out and photograph in general, but especially want to go to certain particular spots, and those spots can become kind of overcrowded. And it's harder maybe to do something, you know, original and different because there's just so many different people doing it. But I still think that there's always room for somebody who has something to say. That if you can, you know, tap into whatever it is that you want to say through your photography, and make images that are meaningful to you, that convey that message, then you can make images that no one else can make, because no one else is you. And so there's always room for that. There's always room for an authentic new voice in photography.
So you ready for the second tough question?
I thought that was it.
But no, that was 1A.
Okay.
Or 1B, right. I guess.
Sure.
So the second tough question is, you know, how is it that Ansel Adams or Michael Fry can stand in front of a group of trees and turn it into this amazing piece of artwork, yet when I do it, it just looks like a bunch of trees? I mean, there's really I don't know if I asked it right, but there's really a good question there. And what can you tell people to help them create their own, you know, images of people looking and go, wow, like that's the thing with Ansel or a lot of your images. You look at it and you go, that is awesome. And you go, yeah, it's just a few birch trees put together. Why is that so awesome?
Well, thanks, first of all. But yeah, it's a tough question to answer. That one's actually a lot tougher than talking about Ansel. but you know, photography is like 90% light and composition, I think. And so we'll start with that. You know, that that's really about those two things. And whether we're talking about a big scene or a small scene, or, you know, a group of trees, whatever it is, that it's really about light and composition. And so, you know, if a tree or a group of trees has some particularly nice light on it, that can make a whole world of difference. And from there, you know, just really finding an arrangement of the elements that you're trying to show in the scene that works, that's cohesive and it's simple and strong. You know, for me, the most sort of important fundamental aspect of composition that, you know, that I talk about all the time and I teach in workshops is just simplicity. And what I mean by that is not necessarily some, you know, sparing Zen-like composition, although it could be that and that could be great, but really just distilling the scene down to its essentials, including only the things that are the most important or the most interesting, that are going to tell the story you want to tell or convey what it is you want to convey. And I'm, you know, I use all kinds of different lenses in my photography, but I use a lot of telephoto lenses, and that's certainly one aspect of that. You know, telephoto lenses allow you to isolate part of a scene that maybe is the most interesting, the most captivating, whatever you want to call it, and so that can help to do that. And then looking for, so, you know, first of all, identifying, I guess, we'll take a step back here, identifying what are the most important essential things that you want to include, and then trying to find a way to include just that and get rid of everything else. And I think it helps to ask yourself, what caught your eye in the first place? You know, so whatever it is, try to make the photograph about that and get rid of everything else that's not that. And it could be, and the more specific you can be, the better, right? So you could say, well, what caught my eye is that tree. Well, okay, great. But what about the tree? You know, is it the shape? Is it the color? Is it the light on it? Is it the juxtaposition of that tree with another tree? Or is it the pattern of that tree in combination with other trees? And so the more specific you can be in terms of answering that question about what caught your eye, then the better you're going to be able to sort of hone in on that and find a composition that'll work. And another element that I, you know, that I talk about all the time that I think is really important is just looking for patterns, repetition. Any kind of repeating pattern, you know, some element, the lines, shapes, it could even be colors that repeats throughout the frame, or even just repeats once. You know, two of some similar line or shape makes a pattern and kind of unifies the photo, creates some rhythm and harmony. And, you know, of course, if you can have more than two, that's even better. But any kind of repeating pattern or element in the photograph is such a powerful thing. We love seeing patterns when we look at pictures. And so, you know, anytime you can find that, that's a really great thing to include and to emphasize in your photo. And kind of, you know, fill up the frame with it if you can. So you know, that's something that I think anybody can do anytime. Like, right, you were walking down this path here, and I see a pattern right here, right? So there's these pine needles draped over some small branches or dogwoods. And so there's just this pattern of repeating pattern of these sort of upside-down Vs of these bunches of pine needles on the branches here. Now, the light's all wrong, but, you know, but there's a pattern there. And in fact, maybe if we went on the other side and looked at them backlit, they might work. But you could be stopped in traffic somewhere waiting for a red light and just look around for patterns. See what kind of patterns you can find. And if you do that enough, you can sort of train your brain to recognize those. And that will really, I think, help strengthen your compositions.
Wow.
How did we get to that?
That was the second tough question.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but what a great answer and so in depth. I mean, that was deep. I mean, we started with what's your favorite iconic locations in Yosemite, and we took it deep.
Yeah, right.
So I love it. Good. I love it. Did we miss anything?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'm sure there are a bunch of other things we could talk about.
Oh,
I can't think of anything, you know, glaring that we missed.
No, this was awesome. Thank you so much, Michael Frye. MichaelFrye.com. That's F-R-Y-E. Get on the blog and see all the things he's up to. Michael's going to be here next year as one of our featured speakers for Out of Yosemite next winter, 2020.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
It's going to be really fun. And Michael and I have been working. He's helping me find just some really unbelievable people that are going to be here helping to do the thing with us. It's going to be awesome.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super fun.
All right. We'll do that. Even though no one will see us shaking hands, there you go.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on. It's been fun. So.
Thank you so much, Michael. All right. See you in February, next winter. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. We'll be right back.